Welcome to the deep dive. Ever notice that the same chemical structure, ethanol, fuels your car as E85 and gives that familiar kick to an adult beverage?
It's pretty amazing, isn't it? One molecule, two very different uses.
Exactly. It's a surprisingly versatile molecule. Now, shift gears completely and imagine the unforgettable, eye-watering stench of a skunk.
Uh-oh. I think I know where this is going.
That, you might be surprised to learn, is thanks to compounds called thiols, which are basically the sulfur-containing cousins of alcohols.
Right, sulfur instead of oxygen.
It's truly amazing how just a single atom change can lead to such wildly different yet universally recognized effects.
Nature's little chemical tweaks can have huge consequences.
Today we're embarking on a deep dive into the fascinating world of alcohols and thiols. Our mission, as always, is to take your sources, in this case, a comprehensive chapter on alcohols, and extract the most important insights. We're going to unpack their fundamental structures, understand their unique physical and chemical properties, explore how they transform into other compounds, and discover their incredible relevance.
From life-saving drugs
to those everyday aromas, both pleasant and, well, less so.
And this isn't just about memorizing chemical formulas, right?
Yeah.
We're going to see how just a few atoms can dictate everything. Like a compound's boiling point, its acidity.
Even how it interacts with biological systems.
Exactly. And the real insight here is how these seemingly simple molecules play a central, almost foundational role in how we understand and manipulate nearly every organic compound around us.
They're like chemical switchblades.
That's a great way to put it. They are the chemical switchblades of the organic world, capable of transforming into so many different things. It's a journey into the heart of organic chemistry.
Okay, let's unpack this and start with the very core of what makes an alcohol. What is its signature chemical fingerprint?
Well, the fundamental building block is pretty simple, actually. It's an OH group. We call it a hydroxyl group.
It's OP.
But here's the crucial detail. It must be attached to a very specific kind of carbon atom.
Okay.
One that's designed to form four single bonds. We call this an sp3 hybridized carbon.
sp3. So that means it has a particular shape.
Precisely. This carbon atom isn't just forming a bond. It's creating a definite three-dimensional space for itself and everything around it. Think tetrahedral.
So it's not just any carbon, but one that has this particular tetrahedral arrangement around it.
Yeah.
And the oxygen in that hydroxyl group isn't just a passive bystander either, right?
That's a really key point. The oxygen atom itself is also sp3 hybridized.
Oh, okay.
It forms a single bond to the carbon and another single bond to the hydrogen, but it also holds two unshared pairs of electrons.
Lone pairs.
Right. Think of these lone pairs as little invisible antennae or maybe tiny magnets. They don't participate in bonding directly, but they hugely influence how the alcohol interacts with other molecules.
Giving you unique properties we'll get into later.
Absolutely. They're responsible for a lot of the interesting behavior. For example, in methanol, CH3OH, the simplest alcohol.
Right.
That COH bond angle is measured at about 108.9 degrees, which is remarkably close to the perfectly tetrahedral angle of 109.5 degrees.
So that gives you a clear picture of its 3D shape. It's not flat.
Definitely not flat. It's a dynamic, spatially aware molecule. That bent shape is really important.
Okay. Once we know what an alcohol is, chemists then classify them.
Mm.
You hear terms like primary, secondary, or tertiary, often shortened to 1 degrees, 2 degrees, or 3 degrees.
Mm-hmm.
And this classification depends entirely on how many other carbon atoms the carbon bearing the OH group is bonded to. Why does this distinction matter so much? Is it just labeling?
Oh, it's much more than just a label. This is a really important question because this classification profoundly influences the alcohol's reactivity.
How it behaves in reactions?
Exactly. How it behaves in chemical reactions. A carbon atom with more alkyl groups attached around that hydroxyl group, think more carbon branches will be much more crowded.
More hindered, as chemists say.
Precisely. More hindered than one with fewer branches. And this crowding, or lack thereof, dictates which reactions are possible, how fast they occur, and even what products are formed.
Oh, I
see. It's a fundamental piece of information that helps us predict and, you know, control chemical transformations.
So if you can imagine it, a primary alcohol's OH is on a carbon connected to only one other carbon. Simple.
Right.
A secondary alcohol's OH is on a carbon connected to two other carbons, getting a bit busier.
Yep.
And a tertiary alcohol's OH is on a carbon connected to three other carbons, really crowded around that OH.
That's it.
And that increasing busyness around the hydroxyl group has a huge impact on what you can do with that molecule in the lab.
A massive impact. It's one of the first things you look at when predicting reactivity.
Right. With all these different structures, how do chemists keep track? They use naming systems, primarily the systematic IUPAC nomenclature, but also more traditional common names for alcohols.
Yeah, you need a clear way to talk about them.
What's the core principle of the IUPAC system for alcohols? How does that work?
Well, the IUPAC system, that's the International Union of Pure and Applied Chemistry, aims for total precision, unambiguous names.
Okay.
You find the longest continuous chain of carbon atoms that contains the OH group. That's your parent alkane.
Like propane butane.
Exactly. And then you change its E suffix at the end to ol.
So propane becomes propanol.
Right. And then you number the chain. You start numbering from the end that gives the carbon bearing, the OH, the lowest possible number.
Lowest number for the OH group. Got it.
And crucially, the hydroxyl group takes precedence over almost all other common substituents, like alkyl groups or halogens, in this numbering scheme.
So the OH group is the star.
Pretty much. So if you have propane and the OH is on the second carbon, it's 2-propanol. If it were on the end carbon of a 3-carbon chain, it'd be 1-propanol.
Makes sense. And the common names, are they just for quick reference, like nicknames?
Exactly. Common names often offer a quick, familiar shorthand, which is super useful in everyday lab talk, much less formal.
Easier to say sometimes.
Definitely. You simply name the alkyl group attached to the OH, like propyl, butyl, isopropyl, and then add the word alcohol.
Ah, okay.
So 1-propanol, the IUPAC name, is often called propyl alcohol, and 2-propanol, which you probably know as rubbing alcohol.
Isopropyl alcohol.
That's the one. Isopropyl alcohol is a perfect example of that common name system. It's less formal, but very handy for quick communication.
And there are others, like tert-butyl alcohol for 2-methyl-2-propanol.
Right. Isobutyl alcohol, the common names, often relate to the branching structure.
So this ability to precisely name and categorize these molecules is really the language of chemistry, isn't it?
It absolutely is. And once you speak it, a whole new world of understanding opens up. You can look at a name and picture the structure, or see a structure and know its precise name.
What about molecules with more than one OH group?
Good question. We call those diols, triols, and so on. For IUPAC naming, you keep the E on the alkane name and add suffixes like diol or triol, along with numbers to show where the OH groups are.
Like 1,4-2-ethanediol.
Exactly, which has a very common name. Ethylene glycol, that's the main component in antifreeze.
Ah.
And 1,4-3-propanitriol is commonly known as glycerol or glycerin. Very important molecule.
So common names pop up a lot for these too.
They do, especially for the simpler ones. The term glycol itself is often used as a common name for 12-versa-2-diol.
And what if there's a double bond and an OH group?
Unsaturated alcohols, you use both suffixes N for the double bond and ol for the alcohol. The OH group usually gets priority in numbering the chain.
So like 2-propan-1-ol.
Perfect example. Also known by its common name, allyl alcohol. Understanding these naming systems really helps you decipher complex chemical structures and appreciate the precision needed in chemistry.
Now that we've got their structures and names down, let's talk about what makes alcohols behave the way they do their physical properties. You mentioned the OH group is key. What gives them this inherent polarity?
Yeah, it all comes back to that OH group we just discussed. Oxygen is highly electronegative.
Meaning it pulls electrons towards itself.
Exactly. It's an electron hog, you could say.
Yeah.
It pulls electron density towards itself from both the carbon and the hydrogen it's bonded to.
Okay.
This gives the oxygen a partial negative charge written as delta minus.
And the carbon and hydrogen?
They get left slightly electron deficient, so they have partial positive charges, delta plus.
So you have a separation of charge within the molecule.
Right. This separation of charge creates what we call a molecular dipole, essentially, a tiny molecular magnet with a positive end and a negative end.
And what do magnets do?
They attract each other. The positive end of one molecule is attracted to the negative end of another.
So these charged regions lead to dipole-dipole interactions.
Precisely. Which are simply attractions between the positive end of one alcohol molecule's dipole and the negative end of another nearby alcohol molecule. It's an intermolecular force. #2.2, the power of hydrogen bonding.
So if alcohols are like little molecular magnets, what happens when that positive end of the dipole is a hydrogen atom specifically bonded to a highly electronegative atom like oxygen? Does that create an even stronger attraction?
Ah, now you're getting to the really special part. That's where hydrogen bonding comes in. And it's a game changer for alcohols.
More powerful than regular dipole-dipole.
Much more powerful. It's a particularly strong type of dipole-dipole interaction. It happens when a hydrogen atom attached to a very electronegative atom like oxygen, nitrogen, or fluorine is strongly attracted to a lone pair of electrons on another electronegative atom nearby.
So the partially positive H is strongly attracted to the partially negative O on another molecule.
Exactly. And what's fascinating here is how something seemingly weak on a per-bond basis. I mean, a single hydrogen bond is much weaker than a covalent bond holding atoms together within the molecule.
Like way weaker.
Oh, yeah. Maybe 5% of the strength of a covalent OH bond. But, and this is the key.
There are lots of them.
Exactly. The cumulative effect of many, many hydrogen bonds, as seen in liquid water or pure alcohols, demands significant energy to overcome.
So, like a collection of sticky notes versus super glue. Individually weak, but if you have thousands of them.
That's a perfect analogy. Individually, they're not strong, but together they hold things firmly. Each OH group in an alcohol can, in theory, participate in up to 3 hydrogen bonds donating its H and accepting via its 2 lone pairs.
Wow. Creating a whole network.
An extensive, interconnected web of attractions. This dramatically influences how these molecules behave in bulk, like in a liquid.
Okay, so if hydrogen bonding demands all this energy to break, fundamentally altering boiling points, what does that mean for how alcohols interact with each other when heated, compared to, say, hydrocarbons?
It means alcohols have significantly higher boiling points than hydrocarbons of comparable molecular weight. And this isn't a minor difference, it's dramatic.
Because you have to break all those hydrogen bonds to get them into the gas phase.
Precisely. Boiling is about overcoming intermolecular forces. This is a direct consequence of the substantial energy required to overcome those strong intermolecular hydrogen bonds in the liquid alcohol.
So even if an alcohol and a hydrocarbon weigh about the same?
The alcohol will almost always have a much higher boiling point. While larger molecules generally have higher boiling points due to other forces, called dispersion forces, hydrogen bonding is the dominant factor when you compare an alcohol to a non-hydrogen bonding compound of similar size.
Give me an example.
Okay, think about methanol, CH3OH, boiling point 65 degrees Celsius. Compare that to ethane, C2H6, similar molecular weight. Ethane boils at minus 89 degrees Celsius.
Wow, huge difference from a room temp liquid to a deep freeze gas.
For ethanol, C2H5OH, boiling point 78 degrees CLO. Compare that to propane, C3H8, again, similar size. Propane boils at minus 42 degrees CLO.
Incredible.
And get this. Compare hexane, a 6-carbon alkane, which boils at 69 degrees CO. And now look at 1-pentanol, a 5-carbon alcohol, slightly lighter. It boils at 138 degrees CO.
Double the boiling point.
And if you add another OH group, like in 1004-butanediol, similar weight, again, the boiling point jumps to 230 degrees C.
That really shows the power of those OH groups. So what does this all mean for practical applications? You mentioned isomers earlier.
Right. Think about the dramatic difference between ethanol, boiling point 78 degrees C, and its constitutional isomer dimethyl ether, CH3OCH3, boiling point negative 24 degrees.
Isomer meaning same atoms, different arrangement.
Exactly. Same chemical formula, C2H6O. But dimethyl ether has no OH bond. It can't hydrogen bond with itself.
So it boils way lower.
Way lower. Right. This isn't a typo. The presence of that polar OH group capable of hydrogen bonding is the sole reason for ethanol's much higher boiling point. Without it, ethanol would be a gas at room temperature, making E85 fuel and alcoholic beverages look a whole lot different.
It really changes everything. It's not just a lab curiosity. It's a practical reality with huge implications. #tag 2.4 solubility in water. So if that stickiness helps alcohol molecules cling to each other, does that same stickiness help them dissolve in, say, water, since water also hydrogen bonds?
Absolutely. You've hit on another crucial physical property influenced by hydrogen bonding, solubility in water.
Okay.
Alcohols are generally much more soluble in water than hydrocarbons of similar molecular weight. And again, it's thanks to hydrogen bonding.
It can hydrogen bond with water.
Precisely. Alcohols can readily form hydrogen bonds with water molecules. The partially negative oxygen of water can accept a hydrogen bond from the alcohol's OH, and the partially positive hydrogens on water can interact with the alcohol's oxygen lone pairs.
Like dissolves, like, but supercharged by hydrogen bonds.
Kind of, yes. The smaller alcohols like methanol, ethanol, and 1-propanol are even infinitely soluble in water. Miscible is the technical term.
Meaning you can mix them in any proportion.
Any proportion, just like mixing water with water.
But I've heard that if an alcohol gets too big, it doesn't dissolve as well. What's going on there? Why does the size matter?
Ah, that's the other side of the coin. The alcohol molecule has two parts. The polar OH group, which loves water, hydrophilic, and the nonpolar hydrocarbon chain, the alkyl group, which hates water, hydrophobic.
The oily part.
Exactly, the oily part. As that nonpolar hydrocarbon portion gets larger and larger, it starts to dominate the molecule's personality.
So the water-hating part takes over.
Right. The molecule becomes less able to form effective hydrogen bonds with water overall, and the nonpolar part tries to avoid the water, leading to lower solubility. It disrupts the water's own hydrogen bonding network without offering enough favorable interactions in return.
So there's a limit.
There is. While one propanol 3 carbons is miscible, one butanol 4 carbons is only slightly soluble, and one pentanol 5 carbons is even less soluble, only about 2.3 grams per 100 milliliters of water.
Hmm.
Compare that to hexane, 6 carbons, no OHs, which is essentially insoluble.
But what if you add more OH groups? Like that diol you mentioned.
Excellent point. An alcohol with two hydroxyl groups, like 1 pound or 4-butanediol, even though it has 4 carbons, is infinitely soluble.
Wow. So the extra OH group completely changes its behavior in water.
It tips the balance. The hydrophilic character from the two OH groups overcomes the hydrophobic nature of the 4-carbon chain, allowing it to hydrogen bond much more effectively with water. It really highlights that interplay between the polar head and the nonpolar tail. Now, if we connect this to the bigger picture, hydrogen bonding isn't just about boiling points or solubility in a beaker. It's the fundamental language of life and medicine.
How so?
Hydrogen bonds are absolutely crucial for organizing biological molecules. Think about the intricate folding of proteins into specific 3D shapes, or the precise pairing of bases in the DNA double helix.
Held together by hydrogen bonds.
Largely, yes. These interactions are essential for structure and function in biology.
So it's not just about molecules bumping into each other, but fitting together like a lock and key, based on these specific interactions.
Precisely. These hydrogen bond donors, like OH or NH groups, and acceptors, oxygen or nitrogen atoms with lone pairs, must be precisely oriented in space relative to each other.
They have to line up just right.
Exactly. This directionality is key to highly specific molecular interactions, like how a drug binds to its target protein.
Can you give an example?
Sure. Take the cholesterol-lowering drug atorvastatin, widely known as Lipitor. This drug specifically binds to and blocks the action of an enzyme in the liver called HMG-CoA reductase.
Preventing cholesterol production.
In part, yes. Now, why is it so specific? Why does it bind so tightly to that enzyme and not others?
Its shape must fit.
That's the first part, yes. The drug's overall shape is perfectly complementary to the enzyme's active site. It literally fits snugly into a binding pocket like a key in a lock.
Okay.
But second, and crucially, it forms many specific hydrogen bonds with functional groups within that active site. The source material shows it forming at least 9 specific hydrogen bonds.
9? That's a lot of connections. Mm-hmm.
It is. And many of these involve hydroxyl groups, either on the atorvastatin molecule itself or on amino acid residues on the enzyme surface. These bonds are like the tumblers in the lock, ensuring only the right key fits and turns. They provide both the strength and the specificity of the binding.
That's a powerful example of how understanding these intermolecular forces allows chemists to design incredibly effective and targeted pharmaceuticals.
Absolutely. They aim to bind strongly to their intended targets while ideally avoiding unwanted interactions with other biomolecules, which could cause side effects. It's molecular precision at its finest, all driven by these fundamental forces like hydrogen bonding, #Tech3, acidity, basicity, and reactivity of alcohols. #3.1 alcohols as acids and bases.
Okay, let's switch gears a bit. It's kind of like alcohols have a secret identity. They can be both givers and takers of protons, meaning they can function as both weak acids and weak bases. How does that work?
They are indeed amphoteric, which is the term for having both acidic and basic character. Let's take the acidic part first.
Okay, acting as an acid.
As weak acids, alcohols can donate that proton, the H+, from their hydroxyl group.
Just like water can donate a proton.
Exactly. Their acidity is actually quite similar to water. We measure acidity using pKi, and lower pKi means stronger acid. Water's pKi is about 15.7. Most simple alcohols have pKi values typically in the 16 to 18 range.
So slightly weaker acids than water mostly.
Generally, yes. Although methanol, the simplest one, has a pKi of 15.5, making it slightly more acidic than water.
Interesting. Does the structure of the alcohol affect its acidity?
It does. Remember how we talked about primary, secondary, tertiary alcohols? The bulkiness of the alkyl group matters here, too.
How so?
Well, when an alcohol loses its proton, it forms a negatively charged ion called an alkoxide ion, RO. For this ion to be stable, it helps if water molecules can surround it and stabilize that negative charge through solvation.
Okay.
As the alkyl group around the oxygen gets bulkier, going from primary to secondary to tertiary, it becomes harder for those water molecules to get close and effectively solvate the alkoxide ion.
More steric hindrance again.
Exactly. Less stabilization means the alkoxide ion is less stable, which in turn means the original alcohol was a weaker acid. So methanol is the most acidic, simple alcohol, and tertiary alcohols like tert-butyl alcohol are the least acidic.
So that surrounding busyness we talked about earlier affects its acidity too. Makes sense. What about acting as a base?
Right, the other side of the coin. In the presence of strong acids, think sulfuric acid, hydrochloric acid, the oxygen atom of an alcohol can act as a base.
Using its lone pairs.
Precisely. Those lone pairs of electrons on the oxygen readily accept a proton, H+, from the strong acid. This forms what's called an oxonium ion, which looks like RO plus H2. The oxygen now has a positive charge.
Okay, so it picks up a proton. Why is that important?
This is a really big deal and a crucial concept in organic chemistry. The OH group itself, just hydroxyl, is actually a poor leaving group in substitution or elimination reactions. It doesn't want to break its bond with the carbon and leave as OH.
It's too unstable on its own.
It's a relatively strong base, so yes, it's not happy leaving like that. But when it gets protonated by a strong acid to form that oxonium ion, O plus H2, it transforms into a much better leaving group.
Why?
Because now, if the CO bond breaks, what leaves is a neutral, very stable water molecule, H2O.
Ah, way better than hydroxide leaving.
Much, much better. This protonation step effectively activates the alcohol, setting the stage for many subsequent reactions, like substitution or elimination, to take place much more easily. It's a common first step in many alcohol reaction mechanisms. #Tag 3.2 reaction of alcohols with active metals.
Beyond their acid-base properties, alcohols have other interesting reactions. For example, they readily react with active metals such as lithium, sodium, and potassium. What's happening there? Is that related to their acidity?
It is related, yes. It showcases their ability to act as an acid, albeit a weak one. In these reactions with active metals, group 1 metals especially.
Like sodium there.
Right. The active metal gets oxidized, it loses an electron. So sodium metal macho becomes a sodium ion, Na+.
Yeah.
And the hydrogen from the alcohol's hydroxyl group gets reduced. It gains an electron, pairs up with another hydrogen atom, and leaves as hydrogen gas, H2.
So you see bubbles.
You often see bubbles of hydrogen gas being released. It can be quite a vigorous reaction, especially with sodium or potassium.
And what's left behind from the alcohol?
You form the metal salt of the alkoxide ion. For example, if you react methanol, CH3OH, with sodium metal Na, you get sodium methoxide, CH3ONA+, and hydrogen gas, H2.
So you're essentially forcing the alcohol to act as an acid using a very reactive metal.
That's a good way to think about it. Mm. Now, these alkoxide ions aren't just a byproduct. They're incredibly useful reagents in their own right.
Useful, ah.
They are very strong bases, generally comparable to or even stronger than hydroxide ions.
Stronger than sodium hydroxide.
Often, yes. Especially the alkoxides derived from bulkier alcohols like potassium tert-butoxide from tert-butyl alcohol. And because they are typically generated and used in the alcohol solvent itself or other non-aqueous solvents.
No water around.
Right. They are widely used in organic reactions that require a strong base where water would interfere with the reaction. Think about sodium ethoxide in ethanol solvent or potassium tert-butoxide, often called KO2, in tert-butyl alcohol or THF. These are standard, powerful reagents that allow chemists to perform very specific synthetic tasks like deprotonations or eliminations.
So there's a way to make a strong base without using water.
Exactly. You can also react alcohols with even stronger bases, like sodium hydride, NaH. Hydride ion, H, is an extremely strong base.
How does that work?
The hydride ion pulls the proton off the alcohol's OH group, forming the alkoxide and H2 gas. This reaction is essentially irreversible because the H2 gas escapes, driving the reaction to completion according to Le Chatelier's principle.
Removing a product pulls the reaction forward.
Precisely. Understanding these reactions helps you appreciate how chemists create specialized tools like these strong alkoxide bases for building complex molecules step by step.
Okay, so we know that OH group in an alcohol isn't a great leading group on its own. We saw how protonating it helps. But what if we want to get rid of it entirely and replace it with something else, like a halogen atom chlorine bromine iodine to create a haloalkane? How do chemists achieve that common transformation?
Right. This is a fundamental conversion. A common theme in alcohol reactions is converting that poor OH leaving group into a better one, often setting it up for substitution by a halogen.
So swap OH for X, where X is a halogen.
Essentially, yes. One common way is to treat the alcohol with strong halogen acids, concentrated HCl, HBr, or HI.
Okay, add strong acid.
Now, how the reaction proceeds depends heavily on the alcohol structure. That primary, secondary, tertiary classification is key here.
Ah, back to that again. How does it differ?
For tertiary alcohols, the conversion happens very rapidly, often just by shaking with concentrated acid at room temperature.
Why so fast?
Because it typically proceeds through an SN1 mechanism. Remember, protonation makes water a good leaving group. Water leaves first, forming a relatively stable tertiary carbocation intermediate. Then, the halide ion, like Cl or Br, quickly attacks the carbocation.
SN1 means substitution, nucleophilic, unimolecular. Relies on that stable carbocation.
Exactly. But with primary alcohols, it's a different story. Primary carbocations are much less stable, so they don't readily form.
So no SN1?
Generally no SN1. Instead, they usually react via an SN2 mechanism.
Substitution, nucleophilic, bimolecular, the direct attack.
Right. After the OH group is protonated to form the good leaving group, water, the halide ion comes in and directly attacks the carbon from the backside, pushing the water molecule out in a single concerted step. This often requires heating.
So the same overall transformation OH to X, but different pathways. SN1 for tertiary, SN2 for primary, depending on carbocation stability. That's a key distinction.
It is.
What about secondary alcohols or something a bit more complex like branched primary alcohols?
Secondary alcohols are sort of in the middle. They can react via either SN1 or SN2, depending on the specific conditions. And sometimes you get a mixture of pathways. They often show some rearranged products too, which is a telltale sign of carbocation intermediates forming, SN1-like behavior.
Rearranged products, the carbon skeleton changes.
Yes. Sometimes, especially with branched primary or secondary alcohols, those carbocation intermediates, even if they form briefly, can actually rearrange themselves internally to form a more stable carbocation before the halogen attaches.
Like a one Grover shift, an atom regroup moves over.
Exactly, a twin Grover 2 hydride shift or a twin Grover 2 alkyl shift. This is a common phenomenon in organic chemistry molecules. We'll literally shift atoms around if it leads to a more stable intermediate, like a tertiary carbocation instead of a secondary one.
So you might not get the product you initially expect.
Yeah, you might not. This highlights that critical principle. The stability of carbocations often dictates the reaction pathway, leading to different mechanisms and sometimes these unexpected rearranged products. It's not just about getting the right ingredients, but also choosing the right recipe, the right reagents and conditions, and understanding the molecule's intrinsic preferences for stability.
Are there other reagents besides HX acids for this conversion? Maybe ones that avoid rearrangements?
Yes, absolutely. For converting alcohols to bromoalkanes, phosphorus tribromide, PBr3, is often used. It's generally milder and works well for primary and secondary alcohols.
How does it work?
It reacts with the alcohol in a way that ultimately leads to an SN2 displacement of a phosphorus-containing leaving group by bromide ion. Because it tends to favor the SN2 pathway, there's often less rearrangement compared to using HBr, especially if you keep the temperature low.
Okay, so PBr3 for bromides, less rearrangement. What about chlorides?
For making chloroalkanes, thionyl chloride, SOCl2, is the most widely used reagent. It's very effective for primary and secondary alcohols.
SOCl2. What's special about it?
It's highly efficient, usually gives good yields, and importantly, the byproducts are gases, SO2 and HCl, which just bubble out of the reaction mixture, helping to drive it to completion.
Convenient.
Very. It's often used with a base like pyridine. A key feature, especially relevant if your alcohol is chiral, has a stereocenter, is that the reaction with SO2 often proceeds with inversion of configuration at the carbon bearing the OH group.
So if you start with an S alcohol, you get an R chloroalkane.
Typically, yes, via an SN2-like mechanism involving an intermediate chlorosulfite ester. This stereochemical control is another advantage. There's also thionyl bromide, SOBr2, which works similarly for making bromides.
So it's clear that chemists have developed different tools, HX, PBr3, SOCl2, each with its own advantages regarding reactivity, conditions, and controlling things like rearrangements or stereochemistry. Choosing the right tool is crucial.
It absolutely is. It's all about picking the right reagent for the specific alcohol and the desired outcome.
Now, what if you want to make that OH group an even better leaving group than water, maybe for a later reaction? But crucially, you want to do it without changing the molecule's existing three-dimensional arrangement around that carbon. Is there a way to do that?
Yes, there is, and it's a very clever and widely used strategy in organic synthesis. This is where forming alkyl sulfonates comes in.
Sulfonates? What are they?
Alcohols can react with compounds called sulfonyl chlorides. Common examples are p-toluene sulfonyl chloride, often abbreviated as TSCL.
Kosyl chloride.
Exactly, kosyl chloride. Or methane sulfonyl chloride, MSCL, methyl chloride. They react with the alcohol's OH group.
What happens in that reaction?
The hydrogen of the OH group is replaced by the sulfonyl group, like the tosyl or methyl group. You form an alkyl sulfonate ester. For example, ethanol reacts with TSCL to form ethyl p-toluene sulfonate or ethyl tosylate, ETOTs.
Okay, so you make this tosylate or methylate. What's the point?
The real insight here is that the resulting sulfonate group, like tosylate OTs or methylate OMs, is an absolutely excellent leaving group.
Why is it so good?
Because the sulfonate anion is the conjugate base of a very strong acid, like p-toluene is sulfonic acid. Strong acid means very stable, very weak conjugate base. These anions are highly stable due to resonance delocalization of the negative charge over the three oxygen atoms bonded to sulfur.
So they're very happy to leave on their own.
Extremely happy.
Wow.
Much better leaving groups than even bromide or iodide in many cases. But here's the brilliant part you asked about.
The stereochemistry.
Yes. This initial transformation, the reaction of the alcohol with the sulfonyl chloride to form the sulfonate ester, does not affect the bond between the carbon and the oxygen of the original alcohol. The CO bond remains intact during this step.
Ah, so the reaction happens at the OH bond, not the CO bond.
Precisely, which means...
If that carbon has a specific handedness, if it's chiral...
Yeah.
You preserve that handedness when you make the sulfonate.
Exactly. If the carbon bearing the OH group is chiral, the sulfonate ester formation proceeds with retention of configuration.
So an S alcohol gives an S sulfonate.
Correct. You're essentially putting a fantastic leaving group disguise onto the original oxygen atom without disturbing the arrangement at the carbon center.
Why is that so useful?
It allows for controlled, predictable stereochemistry in subsequent reactions. Imagine you have an S alcohol. You can convert it to the S tosylate retention. Now, this tosylate is perfectly set up for an SN2 reaction with some nucleophile.
And SN2 reactions proceed with?
Inversion of configuration. So the nucleophile attacks the carbon from the back, kicks out the excellent tosylate leaving group, and you end up with a product that has the opposite configuration at that carbon center.
Wow. So it's a two-step sequence to achieve inversion.
Exactly. Convert alcohol to tosylate retention, then displace tosylate via SN2 inversion. It gives chemists tremendous control over the stereochemical outcome of a reaction. It's a powerful two-step strategy for achieving specific 3D structures, like designing a key to fit a very particular lock. #, #4.3 acid-catalyzed dehydration of alcohols to alkenes.
So we've talked about substituting the OH group either directly or via a sulfonate. But what if we want to remove it entirely, along with a hydrogen from an adjacent carbon, to form a carbon-carbon double bond? This is acid-catalyzed dehydration converting alcohols to alkenes. What drives this transformation?
Right. This is an elimination reaction, not substitution. It involves removing a molecule of water dehydration from the alcohol.
How's it done?
It usually involves heating the alcohol with a strong acid catalyst, like concentrated sulfuric acid, H2SO4, or phosphoric acid, H3PO4.
Heat and strong acid again. Seems common for alcohol reactions.
It is, because that protonation step to make water a good leaving group is often required. Now, the ease of dehydration follows a clear order, which relates back to carbocation stability again.
Let me guess. Tertiary alcohols are easiest.
You got it. Tertiary alcohols dehydrate most easily, often under relatively mild conditions. Hmm. Secondary alcohols require more vigorous conditions, higher temperature, more concentrated acid. And primary alcohols are the most difficult to dehydrate, needing the harshest conditions.
Because tertiary carbocations are the most stable intermediates formed when water leaves.
Exactly. The mechanism for secondary and tertiary alcohols is typically E1, elimination unimolecular. Step one. Protonate the OH. Step two, water leaves, forming a carbocation. This is the slow, rate-determining step. Step three, a base, like water or the conjugate base of the acid catalyst, removes a proton from a carbon adjacent to the carbocation center, and the electrons from that CH bond swing in to form the double bond.
Okay, E1 mechanism. What happens if there's more than one place to form a double bond?
Ah, regioselectivity. If different alkene isomers can be formed, the major product is generally the alkene with the most alkyl groups attached to the double bond carbons.
The more substituted alkene.
Correct. This is known as Zaitsev's rule. The more substituted alkene is usually the more thermodynamically stable one, so it tends to be the major product under these equilibrium conditions.
And what about those rearrangements we talked about earlier? Can they happen here too?
Oh, yes. Carbocation rearrangements are very common in E1 dehydration reactions, especially for secondary alcohols, and even sometimes derived from primary alcohols. If a 1-2 shift, hydride or alkyl, can lead to a more stable carbocation intermediate, for example, secondary to tertiary, it often will happen before the proton is removed to form the alkene.
So you might get alkenes with a different carbon skeleton than you started with.
Absolutely. For example, dehydrating 3-val-3-dimethyl-2-butanol, a secondary alcohol, doesn't just give the expected Zaitsev product. It undergoes a methyl shift to form a tertiary carbocation, leading predominantly to a tetra-substituted alkene you wouldn't predict without considering rearrangement.
It's like the molecule is trying to find its most stable alkene form, even if it means reshuffling its atoms first.
That's a good way to look at it. Now, for primary alcohols, which don't readily form carbocations, the mechanism can be more complex, possibly involving some E2 bimolecular elimination character or rearrangement after forming an initial unstable primary carbocation. For instance, dehydrating 1-butanol gives a mixture of 1-butene and the more stable 2-butene isomers, suggesting rearrangement occurs.
So it's like a molecule shedding water to become more stable by forming a double bond, often the most stable double bond possible.
That's a good summary. And here's an incredibly elegant concept that ties it all together. The principle of microscopic reversibility.
Okay, what's that?
This principle states that the sequence of transition states and reactive intermediates for any reversible reaction must be the same, but in reverse order, for the reverse reaction as for the forward reaction.
So the pathway back is the exact reverse of the pathway forward.
At the molecular level, yes. Now, think about the reaction we just discussed. Acid-catalyzed dehydration of an alcohol to an alkene plus water. Alcohol, alkene plus H2O with acid catalyst.
Okay.
What's the reverse of that reaction?
Adding water to an alkene to make an alcohol, also catalyzed by acid. Alkene hydration.
Precisely. Acid-catalyzed alkene hydration. The principle of microscopic reversibility tells us that the mechanism for dehydration is the exact reverse of the mechanism for hydration. Same intermediates, like the carbocation, same transition states, just traversed in the opposite direction.
That's really neat. It connects two seemingly different reactions.
It's a beautiful example of the fundamental symmetry and interconnectedness in chemical reactions. It also helps explain why the reaction conditions matter. If you have lots of water present, you favor hydration, making the alcohol. If you remove water as it forms, for example, by distilling off the lower boiling alkene, you favor dehydration, making the alkene.
So you can almost think of alcohols and alkenes as two sides of the same coin, constantly transforming based on conditions. This highlights how reaction conditions like the presence or scarcity of water or temperature can shift chemical equilibria to favor desired products. It's all about balancing the conditions to get what you want.
Exactly. It's chemical thermodynamics and kinetics in action.
Moving on to another fascinating transformation, let's first quickly define our starting material. Vicinaldiols, or glycols. These sound a bit like alcohols, but plural.
They are. The vicinaldiols, or just glycols for short, are compounds that contain two OH groups, specifically on adjacent carbon atoms.
So two hydroxyls right next door to each other on the carbon chain.
That's the key. Vicinal means adjacent. They can be synthesized in various ways, for example, by the oxidation of alkenes using reagents like osmium tetroxide, OBSO4, or cold, dilute potassium permanganate, KMnO4. The proximity of the two OH groups is what leads to their unique reactivity in certain reactions. #5.2, the unique pinnacle rearrangement.
Okay, now for the reaction itself. The source calls it the pinnacle rearrangement. This is truly a molecular magic trick, where a molecule completely rearranges its atoms. Glycols undergo a characteristic acid-catalyzed dehydration, but instead of forming a simple alkene like we just discussed for monoalcohols, they yield a completely rearranged aldehyde or ketone product. What's going on here? This sounds quite different.
It is quite different, and it's a brilliant demonstration of how a molecule, when put under stress, like strong acid and heat, can dramatically reconfigure itself, moving entire groups of atoms around, all in the pursuit of greater stability.
So it rearranges itself.
Yes, a rearrangement is the key feature. The classic example, which gives the reaction its name, is the conversion of 2,443-dimethyl-2,443-butanediol.
which has OH groups on carbons 2 and 3, both of which also have two methyl groups.
Exactly. That specific glycol is commonly known as pinacol. When you treat it with concentrated sulfuric acid and heat,
what happened?
It rearranges and dehydrates to form 3,4-3-dimethyl-2-butanone, which is a ketone commonly known as pinacolone.
Whoa. So you lose water, but instead of a double bond, you get a CO group, a ketone, and a methyl group is actually moved from one carbon to the next.
Precisely. Those are the two key insights. One, it's a dehydration that results in an aldehyde or ketone. And two, there's a migration of an entire alkyl group, or sometimes a hydrogen atom, from one carbon to the adjacent carbon atom. It's a dramatic structural change, almost like a molecular shapeshift.
So how does a molecule pull off something so dramatic? What's the mechanism?
Well, like many acid-catalyzed alcohol reactions, it starts with protonation. The acid first protonates one of the OH groups, turning it into a good leaving group, water.
Okay, same first step.
Then that water molecule leaves. This creates a carbocation intermediate on the carbon that lost the water.
Right.
Now, here's where the magic happens, the rearrangement step. An adjacent group, typically an alkyl group like methyl, or sometimes a hydride ion, if available, migrates, bond and all, from the neighboring carbon over to the positively charged carbon.
It just jumps over.
It shifts over, yes. Mm. This is called a 1,4,2 shift. The reason it does this is crucial. This migration simultaneously relieves the positive charge on the first carbon and often creates a new, much more stable conformation.
More stable how?
The resultant conformation is often resonance stabilized. The positive charge ends up on the carbon that still has an OH group attached. This oxygen can use one of its lone pairs to form a double bond with the positively charged carbon.
Ah, so the oxygen helps stabilize the positive charge through resonance, giving an oxonium ion-like structure.
Exactly. This resonance-stabilized carbocation, where both carbon and oxygen effectively have complete octets, as shown in the source, is much more stable than the initial carbocation. That stability is the driving force for the rearrangement.
Okay, so protonation, water loss, once to reshift to form a resonance stabilized carbocation, then what?
The final step is simple deprotonation. A base, like water or HSO4, removes the proton from the oxygen atom of the OH group involved in that resonance structure. The electrons in the OH bond swing down to become the pi bond of the carbonyl group, CO.
And you get your final aldehyde or ketone product and regenerate the acid catalyst.
Precisely. The molecule has successfully rearranged and eliminated water.
Now, in the pinnacle example, it was a symmetrical diol. Does it matter which OH group leaves first?
In symmetrical diols like pinnacle, no. It doesn't matter which OH gets protonated and leaves first or which methyl group migrates. You end up with the same product.
But what about unsymmetrical diols?
Ah, good question. In unsymmetrical diols, the OH group that becomes protonated and leaves is generally the one whose departure forms the more stable carbocation intermediate. For example, if one OH is on a tertiary carbon and the other is on a secondary carbon, the tertiary OH will preferentially leave because a tertiary carbocation is more stable than a secondary one.
And which group migrates? Is there a preference there too?
Yes, there's often a migratory aptitude. Generally, hydride shifts are faster than phenyl group shifts, which are faster than alkyl group shifts. But the driving force is always forming the most stable possible intermediate after the shift. For instance, if migrating a hydride leads to that resonance stabilized catalyst we talked about, that's likely to happen. The source shows an example where 2-methyl-1-ver-2-propanediol rearranges via a hydride shift to form 2-methylpropanol, an aldehyde.
This rearrangement is a beautiful demonstration of how molecules can optimize their stability by moving atoms around, driven by fundamental principles like carbocation stability and resonance, and how seemingly minor structural differences can lead to vastly different reaction pathways and products. It's a testament to the dynamic nature of organic chemistry.
It really is. It's not just static structures. Molecules are constantly exploring ways to reach lower energy states, sometimes through these quite complex rearrangements.
Okay, moving from rearrangements, let's dive into another fundamental transformation, alcohol oxidation. These reactions are absolutely critical for synthesizing a whole range of carbonyl compounds, aldehydes, ketones, and carboxylic acids. What's the core principle here? What actually happens during oxidation?
Oxidation, in this context, usually means increasing the number of bonds between carbon and oxygen or decreasing the number of bonds between carbon and hydrogen. Alcohol oxidation specifically converts the COH group into a CO group, a carbonyl.
Forming that double bond to oxygen.
Right. Now, the key principle, the prerequisite for an alcohol to be oxidized at the carbon bearing the OH group, is that there must be at least one hydrogen atom directly attached to that same carbon.
The carbonyl hydrogen.
Exactly. That CH bond is broken during the oxidation process, allowing the CO bond to form. This immediately tells us something about different types of alcohol.
Based on our primary, secondary, tertiary classification.
Precisely. Primary alcohols have two hydrogens on the carbon with the OH group, RCH2OH. Secondary alcohols have one hydrogen, R2CHOH. Tertiary alcohols have zero hydrogens on that carbon, R3COH.
So
primary alcohols can be oxidized. They first form aldehydes, or CHO, where one CH bond is replaced by a CO bond. But often, if the oxidizing agent is strong enough and water is present, the aldehyde can be oxidized further to a carboxylic acid, or COH.
Okay, primary can go to aldehyde, then potentially to carboxylic acid. What about secondary?
Secondary alcohols have one carbonyl hydrogen. They can be oxidized cleanly to ketones, R2CO. Once you form the ketone, there are no more hydrogens on that carbonyl carbon, so the oxidation stops there under typical conditions.
Secondary gives ketones. Makes sense. And tertiary?
Tertiary alcohols have no hydrogens on the carbon bearing the OH group. Since breaking a CH bond on that carbon is essential for forming the CO group, tertiary alcohols are generally resistant to oxidation under conditions that oxidize primary and secondary alcohols. They lack the necessary ingredient.
No carbonyl hydrogen, no oxidation.
Got it.
For a long time, the go-to oxidizing agent in the lab was chromic acid, often generated from chromium trioxide, CrO3, or sodium potassium dichromate, and ATCr2O7, K2Cr2O7, and aqueous sulfuric acid. Mm. It's often used as the Jones reagent, which is a specific solution in acetone, quite a powerful one. What does it do to different alcohols?
It certainly is powerful, and it follows the rules we just discussed. When you use chromic acid, H2Cr4, or the Jones reagent on primary alcohol.
Like one hexanol.
Yes. They are oxidized all the way to carboxylic acid, so one hexanol would become hexanoic acid.
Why all the way? Why doesn't it stop at the aldehyde?
This is a key point about using chromic acid in aqueous acid. The aldehyde, hexanol in this case, which is formed initially, readily reacts with water present in the acidic solution to form an intermediate called an aldehyde hydrate.
A hydrate? What's that?
It's where water essentially adds across the CO bond, forming a geminal diol, two OH groups on the same carbon, RCHOH2. Now, this hydrate looks like an alcohol, again, in a sense. It has an OH group and a hydrogen on the same carbon.
And chromic acid can oxidize that.
Exactly. Chromic acid can oxidize the hydrate just like it oxidized the original alcohol, leading to the carboxylic acid. The hydration step is critical because chromic acid itself doesn't readily react directly with the aldehyde carbonyl group, but it does react with the hydrate's OH group.
So in water, the aldehyde intermediate gets trapped as a hydrate and then oxidized further.
Yeah.
Clever, but means you can't stop at the aldehyde stage easily with Jones reagent.
Correct. If you want the carboxylic acid from a primary alcohol, Jones reagent is great.
What about secondary alcohols?
Secondary alcohols like menthol, as shown in the source, are oxidized cleanly to ketones, menthone in this case.
And it stops there.
Yes, because the ketone has no hydrogen on the carbonyl carbon, and ketones don't readily form hydrates under these conditions to the same extent aldehydes do. So the reaction stops nicely at the ketone stage.
So if you oxidize one hexanol primary with chromic acid, you get hexanoic acid.
Hmm.
But if you oxidize a secondary alcohol like menthol, you get menthone, a ketone,
mm-hmm.
and a tertiary alcohol like 1-methylcyclopentanol mentioned in the source.
Shows no reaction, no oxidation, just as we predicted, because it lacks that crucial hydrogen on the carbon bearing the OH.
Now, how does this chromic acid oxidation actually work? What's the mechanism?
The mechanism involves the alcohol first reacting with chromic acid to form an intermediate called an alkyl chromate ester. This step doesn't change the oxidation state of chromium yet.
Okay, form the ester.
Then, in the key oxidation step, a base, usually water, removes a proton from the carbon that originally bore the OH group. Simultaneously, the CH bond breaks, its electrons swing in to form the CO double bond, and the chromium atom gets reduced. It gains electrons, typically going from chromium to chromium us.
So it's a concerted removal of H plus from the carbon and breaking of the CH bond, coupled with reduction of chromium.
That's the essence of it. The chromium is the oxidizing agent accepting electrons while the alcohol is oxidized.
And you mentioned this isn't just theory. It's used in real-world applications like roadside breathalyzers.
That's right. The original chemical breath alcohol screening test, the breathalyzer, relied on exactly this chemistry.
How did it work?
The suspect would breathe into a tube containing crystals coated with potassium dichromate, Cr2O72, which is reddish-orange, in acid. If ethanol was present in their breath, it would react with the dichromate.
Oxidizing the ethanol.
Yes. oxidizing the ethanol to acetic acid, carboxylic acid. In the process, the chromium in the dichromate gets reduced to chromium 3 ions, Cr3+, which are green.
Ah, so the color change from orange to green indicated the presence of alcohol.
Exactly. And the extent of the color change, measured photometrically, could be correlated to the amount of ethanol in the breath, giving an estimate of blood alcohol content. It's a direct application of the oxidation chemistry we just discussed.
Okay, so chromic acid in water takes primary alcohols all the way to carboxylic acids because the intermediate aldehyde forms a hydrate. What if you want to stop the oxidation of a primary alcohol at the aldehyde stage? Is there a region for that?
Yes, absolutely. This was a significant challenge for synthetic chemists for a long time, but specialized reagents were developed. One of the most common and effective is pyridinium chlorochromate, usually abbreviated as PCC.
PCC. What is it, and why does it stop at the aldehyde?
PCC is a complex of chromium trioxide, CrO3, with pyridine and HCl. It's typically used as a solid reagent. The crucial difference is how it's used. PCC oxidations are carried out in anhydrous, water-free, organic solvents like dichloromethane, CH2Cl2.
No water present.
Exactly. That's the key. Without water, the intermediate aldehyde that forms from the primary alcohol cannot form the aldehyde hydrate.
Oh. No hydrate, no further oxidation.
Precisely. Since the hydrate is necessary for the second oxidation step to the carboxylic acid, as we saw with Jones reagent, using PCC in a non-aqueous solvent effectively stops the reaction at the aldehyde stage.
Very clever. Just control the solvent.
It's a subtle but critical detail that allows for precision in synthesis. PCC is therefore the reagent of choice when you want to convert a primary alcohol specifically to an aldehyde.
Does it affect other functional groups, like double bonds?
PCC is also relatively mild and generally doesn't affect isolated carbon-carbon double bonds or other easily oxidized groups, which is another advantage. The source shows an example using geraniol, a primary alcohol that also contains two Cicchicelli double bonds.
What happens?
PCC oxidizes the primary alcohol group to an aldehyde geraniol without disturbing the double bonds. It offers good selectivity.
So that's why you can take something like geraniol and oxidize it cleanly to geraniol using PCC. It's about being precise. Does PCC work on secondary alcohols too?
Yes, it does. PCC will also oxidize secondary alcohols to ketones, just like chromic acid does. But its main utility lies in that selective oxidation of primary alcohols to aldehydes.
It's fascinating how chemistry is constantly evolving. The source mentions some newer methods for alcohol oxidation. These show how chemists are finding more efficient and, importantly, more environmentally friendly ways to do things, especially moving away from those potentially toxic chromium compounds like PCC and Jones reagent. What are some of these modern approaches?
Yes, there's been a big push towards greener chemistry, avoiding heavy metals like chromium where possible. Two very prominent and widely used non-chromium oxidation methods are the Swern oxidation and the Desmartin periodinane DMP oxidation.
Okay, Swern and Desmartin, what do they do?
Fundamentally, they achieve the same transformations as the chromium reagents. They oxidize primary alcohols to aldehydes and secondary alcohols to ketones. Tertiary alcohols remain unreactive.
So same outcome, different chemicals. What's involved in the Swern oxidation?
The Swern oxidation uses a combination of dimethyl sulfoxide, DMSO, and oxalochloride, COCl2, at low temperature, often around negative 78 degrees C, dry ice temperature, followed by the addition of a non-nucleophilic amine base, like triethylamine, ET3N.
DMSO, oxalochloride, and a base. Sounds complex.
The mechanism is a bit intricate, involving activation of DMSO by oxalochloride to form a chlorosulfonium salt. This then reacts with the alcohol, and after deprotonation by the amine base, an internal rearrangement occurs that forms the carbonyl product and dimethyl sulfide, which has a notoriously bad smell, a minor drawback.
But it avoids chromium.
Exactly. It's a very reliable and widely used method, especially for sensitive molecules, because it runs under mild basic conditions.
And the Desmartin oxidation, what's DMP?
Desmartin periodinane, DMP, is a specific compound containing iodine in a high oxidation state. It's a hypervalent iodine reagent.
Iodine instead of chromium or sulfur.
Right. DMP is used directly as the oxidizing agent, typically in a solvent like dichloromethane, often at room temperature. It's become very popular because it's relatively stable, easy to handle compared to Swern precursors, works under mild conditions, and gives high yields for converting primary alcohols to aldehydes and secondary alcohols to ketones.
How does it work?
Again, the mechanism is somewhat complex, but it involves the alcohol reacting with the DMP reagent, followed by steps involving acetate displacement and reduction of the iodine center, ultimately releasing the carbonyl product.
So SWERN and DMP are powerful alternatives in the synthetic chemist's toolbox.
Definitely. They offer excellent ways to achieve these crucial oxidations, often with high selectivity and functional group tolerance, and crucially, without using chromium, which is a significant environmental benefit. It represents a huge leap for more sustainable chemical synthesis. #tag 6.5 periodic acid oxidation of glycols.
Now let's look at an oxidation that's very specific and actually cleaves a carbon-carbon bond. The source mentions periodic acid, HiO4 or H5IO6, being used specifically for the cleavage of glycols, those vicinal diols we discussed earlier. So it literally breaks the molecule apart between the two OH groups.
That's exactly right. Periodic acid is a selective oxidizing agent that cleaves the carbon-carbon bond between the two hydroxyl groups of a vicinal diol.
What are the products?
The reaction results in the formation of two separate carbonyl groups. If the original glycol carbons each had a hydrogen, you get two aldehydes. If they were secondary alcohol carbons, you get two ketones. If one was primary and one secondary, you get an aldehyde and a ketone. Essentially, each COH group is oxidized to a COX, and the bond connecting them is broken.
Wow. How does it manage that? What's the mechanism?
The key insight here involves the geometry. Periodic acid first reacts with the glycol to form a cyclic period 8 ester intermediate. This is a 5-membered ring containing the iodine atom, the two oxygen atoms from the glycol, and the two carbon atoms that bore the OH groups.
A cyclic intermediate.
Yes. Then this cyclic intermediate undergoes a concerted rearrangement of electrons. The C-C bond between the two former glycol carbons breaks. The electrons forming that bond move to form the new CO double bonds, and the OI bonds break, reducing the iodine. This all happens in one smooth electronic reshuffle within the cyclic intermediate.
And that leads to the two separate carbonyl products.
Exactly. Now, here's what's absolutely crucial and really cool about this reaction. The formation of that 5-membered cyclic period 8 intermediate is essential.
Why is that important?
Because it dictates the stereochemical requirement for the reaction. Only glycols, where the two RH groups can actually come together to form that cyclic intermediate, can react. This usually means cis glycols, where the OH groups are on the same side, especially in cyclic systems, react readily.
What about trans glycols, where the OH groups are on opposite sides?
Trans diols, particularly in rigid ring systems, where the OH groups are held far apart and cannot bridge the iodine atom to form the cyclic ester, are often completely unreactive towards periodic acid.
So the geometry is everything.
It is. The source shows an example with cis and trans dicyllenediols. The cis isomer is readily cleaved by periodic acid, while the trans isomer, where the OH groups are too far apart, doesn't react. It's a beautiful demonstration of how the precise spatial arrangement of functional groups can fundamentally determine whether a reaction pathway is even possible. It's not just about having the right groups, but having them in the right place relative to each other. Now, if we connect this back to the biological world, nature doesn't usually rely on things like chromic acid or periodic acid to carry out oxidations. It uses a different, far more sophisticated approach, relying on complex organic molecules called coenzymes.
Coenzymes acting as oxidizing agents.
Yes. For alcohol oxidation in biological systems, one of the most important coenzymes is nicotinamide adenine dinucleotide, which exists in an oxidized form, NAD plus R, and a reduced form, NADH.
NAD plus R, that sounds familiar from biology classes. So NAD plus is like nature's precision oxidizing agent for alcohols.
Exactly. NAD plus acts as a two-electron oxidizing agent. When it oxidizes an alcohol, NAD plus accepts the equivalent of a hydride ion, H, a proton plus two electrons, from the alcohol substrate, becoming reduced to NADH. The alcohol, having lost the H, becomes oxidized to an aldehyde or ketone.
So it's a hydride transfer.
Effectively, yes. The overall process often involves an enzyme catalyst as well, which holds both the alcohol substrate and the NAD plus coenzyme in the perfect orientation for the reaction to occur.
Can you give some biological examples?
Sure. We see this in fundamental biological processes. For instance, the first step in the liver's detoxification of ethanol, drinking alcohol, is its oxidation to acetaldehyde. This reaction is catalyzed by the enzyme alcohol dehydrogenase, using NAD plus as the oxidizing agent.
So ethanol plus NAD plus acetaldehyde plus NADH plus H plus brand.
Precisely. Another key example is in metabolism, like the oxidation of lactate to pyruvate, a crucial step in deriving energy from carbohydrates. This is catalyzed by lactate dehydrogenase, again using NAD plus as the coenzyme.
And these enzymes must be very specific.
Incredibly specific. Enzymes ensure that this hydride transfer occurs efficiently and often stereoselectively, meaning only one specific hydrogen atom is transferred, or the hydride is delivered to only one face of the NAD plus molecule. This highlights the exquisite control and precision found in biological reactions compared to typical lab chemistry.
The elegance of nature's chemistry is truly mind-blowing. How it mirrors and often surpasses lab reactions using these specialized molecular tools like NAD plus and enzymes. It's a different kind of chemical engineering optimized over millennia.
It really is. Understanding how NAD plus NADH works is fundamental to understanding biochemical energy transfer and metabolism.
Okay, let's wrap up by exploring alcohol's cousins, the thiols. We mentioned them briefly at the start.
Yeah.
How does swapping that oxygen atom for a sulfur atom change things? Let's start with the basics. Structure and naming. Thiols are simply the sulfur analogs of alcohols, right?
That's the core idea. Instead of an OH hydroxyl group, thiols contain an SH group, which is called a sulfhydryl group, or sometimes a thiol group or mercapto group.
So RSH instead of ROH?
Exactly. Structurally, it's very similar to alcohols in that the SH group is typically bonded to an SD3 hybridized carbon.
Okay. Any differences in shape?
Well, sulfur is larger than oxygen. It's in the period below oxygen on the periodic table. This affects bond lengths and angles slightly. If you consider methanethiol, CH3SH, the sulfur analog of methanol, its CSH bond angle is around 100.3 degrees.
Smaller than the angle in methanol, around 109.
Yes, slightly smaller. This suggests maybe a bit more P character in sulfur's bonding orbitals compared to oxygen's sp3 hybridization, or perhaps less repulsion between bonding pairs due to the longer CS and SH bonds. The geometry is still roughly tetrahedral around the carbon, but the SH group itself is a bit different angularly.
Interesting. Now, how do we name these? Is it similar to alcohol?
Yes, the IUPAC naming system is quite similar. You find the longest carbon chain containing the SSH group, name the parent alkane, but here's a slight difference. You retain the final E of the alkane name and simply add the suffix, thiol.
Ah, keep the E. So butane becomes butanethiol.
Correct. And just like with alcohols, you number the chain to give the carbon bearing the SH group the lowest possible number. The SH group takes precedence over alkyl groups and halogens in numbering. So CH3CH2 CH2CH2SH is one butanethiol.
What if you have both an OH and an SH group in the same molecule? Which gets priority?
Good question. The H group takes precedence over the SH group in IUPAC nomenclature. So if both are present, the compound is named as an alcohol, and the SH group is indicated using the prefix sulfonyl or the older prefix mercapto.
So CH2CH2OH would be 2-sulfonylethanol.
Perfect.
And what are common names? You mentioned mercaptans earlier.
Right. That's the older but still widely used common naming system. Thiols are often called mercaptans.
Why mercaptan? What does that mean?
It's a fascinating name derived from the Latin mercurium captans, which literally means mercury capturing.
Capturing mercury.
Yes, because thiols react readily with heavy metal ions like mercury 2 at HG2 plus to form very stable precipitates. This property was recognized early on.
So how are the common names formed?
Similar to common names for alcohols. You name the alkyl group attached to the SH and then add the word mercaptan.
So one butanethiol is also called?
Butyl mercaptan. And CH3SH is methyl mercaptan, or methanethiol in IUPAC. These naming systems help us precisely communicate about these intriguing sulfur analogs.
Now, for maybe their most outstanding physical characteristic. The powerful, often incredibly unpleasant stench of low molecular weight thiols. Why are they so notorious for their smell? What's going on chemically?
Yeah, that's what everyone remembers about thiols. The smell is truly unforgettable.
To gunks.
Skunks are the classic example. The scent of skunks, but also things like rotten eggs. That's more hydrogen sulfide, H2S, the simplest thiol analog. Garlic, onions, and even sewage often involves thiols or related sulfur compounds.
Were specific thiols responsible for skunk spray?
Yes. Chemists have identified the primary culprits.
Yeah.
Two major ones are 2-butene-1 thiol and 3-methyl-1-butanethiol. They are incredibly potent odorants. The human nose is extremely sensitive to them, even at tiny concentrations.
So potent they use them as additives.
Ironically, yes. Because their smell is so strong and recognizable, small amounts of thiols, like 2-methyl-2-propanethiol, tert-butyl-mercaptan, are deliberately added to natural gas, which is naturally odorless, as a safety measure.
So you can smell a gas leak.
Exactly. These particular thiols are chosen because they don't easily oxidize, and they penetrate soil well, making leaks easily detectable even underground.
Okay, so they smell bad, What about their other physical properties, like boiling points and solubility? How do they compare to alcohols?
Here's where the difference between sulfur and oxygen really shows up again, particularly regarding hydrogen bonding. Remember how crucial hydrogen bonding was for alcohols?
Yes, leading to high boiling points and water solubility.
Well, the sulfur-hydrogen SH bond in thiols is much less polar than the oxygen-hydrogen OH bond in alcohols. Sulfur is less electronegative than oxygen, and it's larger, so the electronegativity difference between S and H is quite small.
Meaning the SH bond is almost nonpolar.
Pretty much. As a result, thiols exhibit very little, almost negligible, intermolecular hydrogen bonding compared to alcohols. They don't have that strong attraction between molecules.
So no strong hydrogen bonding network means they don't stick to each other as much.
Exactly. And what does that imply for boiling points?
It should be much lower than alcohols of similar size.
Precisely. Thiols have significantly lower boiling points compared to alcohols of comparable molecular weight. It's a dramatic difference. For example, we saw ethanol boils at 78 degrees C. It's sulfur analog ethanethiol, CH3CH2SH.
What's its boiling point?
Only 35 degrees C. It's barely a liquid at warm room temperature.
Wow, that's a huge drop, over 40 degrees, just by swapping O for S.
It really highlights the impact of hydrogen bonding. In fact, ethanethiol's boiling point of 35 degrees C is almost identical to its constitutional isomer, dimethyl sulfide, CH3SCH3, which boils at 37 degrees C. Dimethyl sulfide has no SH bond and definitely can't hydrogen bond. The fact that ethanethiol boils at virtually the same temperature reinforces that there's minimal hydrogen bonding happening between thiol molecules.
Fascinating. What about solubility in water?
Again, because they can't effectively hydrogen bond with water molecules either, thiols are much less soluble in water and other polar solvents compared to their alcohol counterparts. They are more like hydrocarbons in terms of their solubility behavior.
So that single atom change oxygen to sulfur dramatically lowers the boiling point, reduces water solubility, and introduces that characteristic powerful odor. It really is a world of difference.
It truly demonstrates the power of subtle changes in atomic properties and bonding on macroscopic physical characteristics.
Despite their similarities in structure, there's another key difference in chemical behavior. Thiols are weak acids, yes, but they are considerably stronger acids than alcohols. Mm-hmm. Why is that? Why is sulfur better at letting go of its proton than oxygen is?
This is another great illustration of how periodic trends, specifically atomic size, can fundamentally alter chemical properties like acidity.
Sulfur is bigger than oxygen.
Yes. Sulfur is a third period element right below oxygen, a second period element, in the periodic table. This means sulfur atoms are significantly larger than oxygen atoms.
Okay. How does size affect acidity?
When a thiol loses its proton, H+, it forms a thiolate anion, RS. When an alcohol loses its proton, it forms an alkoxide anion, RS. The key is the stability of these resulting anions.
The negative charge.
Right. In the thiolate anion, RS, that negative charge resides primarily on the sulfur atom. Because sulfur is larger than oxygen, that negative charge can be spread out or delocalized over a larger volume of space.
Like spreading the charge thinner.
Exactly. Spreading the charge over a larger area makes the anion more stable. In contrast, the negative charge on the smaller oxygen atom in an alkoxide ion, RO, is concentrated in a smaller region, making it less stable, more reactive, more basic.
So a more stable conjugate base, thiolate, means the original acid, thiol, was stronger?
Precisely. Because the thiolate anion is more stable than the alkoxide anion, the thiol, RSH, is more willing to give up its proton than the corresponding alcohol, ROH.
How much stronger are we talking? What are the pK values like?
It's a significant difference. We said alcohols typically have pK values around 16-18. Thiols generally have pK values in the range of 10-11.
Wow, that's a huge difference on the logarithmic pK scale, like 5 to 8 orders of magnitude more acidic.
It is. For comparison, H2S, pK 7.0, is much stronger than H2O, pK 15.7. And ethanethiol, pKa 10.5, is significantly more acidic than ethanol, pKa 15.9.
What does this mean practically?
It means that thiols are acidic enough to react completely with strong aqueous bases like sodium hydroxide, NaOH, to form sodium thiolate salts, RSNA+. Alcohols, being much weaker acids, generally don't react significantly with NaOH. You need much stronger bases like sodium metal or NaH to deprotonate them fully.
So you can easily make thiolate anions using standard bases.
Yes, which is useful because thiolate anions themselves are important reagents, acting as good nucleophiles, for example.
The sulfur atom in thiols is also quite unique compared to oxygen because it's more easily oxidized. Sulfur can exist in several higher oxidation states. What's the most common and important outcome when you gently oxidize a thiol?
Indeed, the sulfur atom in a thiol SSH group, sulfur is in the 9s2 oxidation state typically, is readily oxidized. One of the most common and biochemically important reactions is their oxidation by relatively mild oxidizing agents.
Like what?
Agents like molecular oxygen O2 from the air, or iodine I2, or even hydrogen peroxide H2O2 under certain conditions.
What happens in this mild oxidation?
This readily converts two molecules of a thiol RSH into a disulfide RSSR. A new sulfur bond is formed and the hydrogen atoms are lost.
So two RSH gets oxidized to RSS.
Exactly. You form that characteristic disulfide linkage. The reaction is so facile, in fact, that thiols are often susceptible to air oxidation just upon standing.
So they need to be protected from air during storage?
Often, yes, especially if you want to keep them purely as the thiol. Otherwise, they might slowly convert to the disulfide over time.
Now, you said this oxidation reduction reaction, thiol to disulfide and back, is incredibly important in biological systems. How?
It truly is. It plays a critical role in protein structure and function. The amino acid L-cysteine contains a thiol group, Nash's CH2SH, in its side chain.
Cysteine. Okay.
Within protein chains, two cysteine residues that might be far apart in the linear sequence but come close together in 3D space can be oxidized to form a disulfide bond between their side chains. This is called a disulfide bridge or disulfide linkage.
Linking two parts of the protein chain together.
Exactly. These disulfide bonds act like molecular staples or crosslinks, playing a major role in stabilizing the specific three-dimensional folded structure, the tertiary or quaternary structure, of many proteins, particularly those that exist outside of cells.
So they help lock the protein into its functional shape.
Precisely. Think about keratin, the protein that makes up your hair and nails. Keratin is rich in cysteine, and the extensive network of disulfide bonds gives hair its strength and shape.
Oh. Is this related to getting a perm?
It's exactly the chemistry behind permanent waves and also hair relaxers.
How did that work?
The process typically involves first applying a reducing agent to break the existing disulfide bonds in the hair's keratin. Then the hair is mechanically reshaped, CCG, wound around curlers for a perm or straightened. Finally, an oxidizing agent is applied to allow new disulfide bonds to form, locking the hair into its new configuration.
Wow. So breaking and reforming those SS bonds based on thiol to sulfide chemistry is what changes your hair shape. That's a fantastic everyday example of this fundamental chemical process at work.
It really is. It underlines how important this seemingly simple thiol to disulfide conversion is, both in the lab and in biology. And just to add, thiols, and especially thiolate anions, RS, are also generally better nucleophiles than their oxygen counterparts, alcohols and alkoxides, RO.
Why is that?
It's partly due to sulfur's larger size and greater polarizability. Its electron cloud is more easily distorted, making it better able to initiate attack on electrophilic centers. So thiols add another layer of distinct reactivity compared to alcohols. Hashtag tag outro.
What an incredible journey we've had, diving deep into the world of alcohols and thiols. We started with that simple OH group, unpacked structures, naming.
And then saw how that OH group dominates physical properties through hydrogen bonding affecting boiling points, solubility.
Right. We dissected their roles as both weak acids and weak bases, saw how activating the OH group is key to many reactions.
Like converting them into haloalkanes using different regions like HX, PBr3, or SOCl2, each with its own nuances regarding mechanism and stereochemistry.
Or making those superleading groups, the sulfonates, with retention of configuration.
And then the elimination reactions dehydrating alcohols to alkenes, remembering Zaitsev's rule and the potential for rearrangements.
You're not forgetting that amazing pinacol rearrangement where glycols do that molecular shapeshift to form ketones.
That was a fun one. And of course, the crucial oxidation reactions, primary alcohols to aldehydes or carboxylic acids, secondary to ketones.
Using classic reagents like Jones or PCC, but also highlighting the Greener-Swern and Des-Martin oxidations.
And the specific cleavage of glycols with periodic acid, driven by that cyclic intermediate.
And finally, we explored the thiols, the sulfur cousins. How that single atom change brings the stench.
But also lowers boiling points due to lack of hydrogen bonding, makes them stronger acids.
And introduces that vital thiol disulfide redox chemistry, so important for protein structure like in our hair.
We've seen how understanding these fundamental molecular dances allows for precise control in chemical synthesis, for designing life-saving drugs like atorvastatin that rely on specific hydrogen bonds.
And even for developing practical tools like the original breathalyzer, based on alcohol oxidation.
The elegance of concepts like microscopic reversibility, connecting hydration and dehydration, and the specific geometry required for reactions like the periodic acid oxidation of glycols truly illustrate the beauty and, you know, the underlying logic inherent in chemistry.
It really does. So as you go about your day, maybe you fill up your car with E85 or take medicine or just hopefully not too often smell a skunk. Remember the hidden world of alcohols and thiols. Think about how their molecular dance dictates so much around us.
It makes you wonder, what other everyday substances do you think might hide such fascinating chemical stories just waiting for a deep dive?
That's a great thought to leave listeners with. There's chemistry everywhere.
Until next time on The Deep Dive.